everybody. Welcome back to another episode of On The Mix. I'm your host, Lindsay, and I thought it was very appropriate to talk to you guys today about Bob Marley because there is a new biopic that just came out. I figured that it would be a good time to kind of speak about Bob Marley and who he was, but also to really get into this whole story about when he was almost assassinated. Was the CIA involved in his death? Was it just the political stance in Jamaica and did it have nothing to do with the CIA? Or was it the CIA's doing? We're going to get into the nitty-gritty of exactly what happened to Bob Marley. And his story is a really sad one. Like, he didn't live that long, actually. He lived to only be 36 and he died very tragically also. But this assassination attempt was an absolutely harrowing story. So we're going to get into all of it. So let's just dive in. Who is Bob Marley? Well, he was actually born Robert Nesta Marley on February 6, 1945, in Nine Mile, St. Anne Parish, Jamaica. In February of 1962, Bob recorded four songs, Judge Not, One Cup of Coffee, Do You Still Love Me, and Terror at Federal Studios for local music producer Leslie Kong. Three of the songs were released on Beverly's, with One Cup of Coffee being released under the pseudonym Bobby Martell. Then, a year later, in 1963, Bob was part of the ensemble at the time called The Teenagers, but then they later changed the name to The Wailing Rude Boys, then to The Wailing Wailers, and then at some point when they were discovered by record producer Coxon Dodd, they then just simply became Bob Marley and The Wailers, which is what his band has always been known as. In 1966, Bob married Rita Anderson and moved near his mother's house in Wilmington, Delaware, in the United States for a very short period of time, during which he worked as a DuPont lab assistant and as a forklift operator at a Chrysler plant in nearby Newark, New Jersey, under the alias Donald Marley. Though he was raised as a Catholic, Bob became interested in Rastafari beliefs in the 60s. After returning to Jamaica from living near his mom's house in Delaware, Bob converted to Rastafari and began to grow dreadlocks. By 1969, reggae was morphing into what we know of it to sound like today. At first, reggae was kind of more fast-paced, you know, very upbeat. But now we know reggae to be slower in beat and in rhythm. And that was first heard on this song called Do the Reggae by this reggae group called the Maytals. The first iteration of modern reggae as we know it came from this song here. So upon hearing this new change in reggae, Bob approached Leslie Kong, who was regarded as one of the major developers of the reggae sound, and obviously they had worked together previously in Bob's career when he first was doing music. And from this point on now, Bob Marley and the Wailers, their music changed a little bit to kind of fit with this new sound that reggae was developing. In 1972, Bob was signed with CBS Records in London and embarked on a UK tour with soul singer Johnny Nash. He was best known in the United States for his 1972 hit I Can See Clearly Now. While Bob was in London, the Wailers asked their road manager, Brent Clark, to introduce them to Chris Blackwell, who was the founder of Island Records. Their road manager, Brent, had licensed some of their songs to Island Records, and they intended to discuss the royalties associated with these releases on Island Records because they were now negotiating terms to be with them. But the meeting resulted in an offer of an advanced £4,000 to record an album. And they were pretty okay with that. The Wailers returned to Jamaica to record the album Catch a Fire under Island Records, and Catch a Fire marked the first time a reggae band had access to state-of-the-art studios and were given the same care as their rock and roll counterparts. It kind of sucks that they weren't afforded or they weren't given the same kind of rights and respect as their rock and roll peers prior to them getting on Island Records and prior to them trying to make a name for themselves, but that is unfortunately how it goes in the music industry. Their album Catch a Fire was released in April of 1973, and it was packaged like a rock record with a unique Zippo lighter lift top on the jacket. It initially sold 14,000 units, and it received positive remarks from critics. It was followed later that year by the album Burnin', which included the song I Shot the Sheriff. And it was made famous, more so famous, by Eric Clapton. He was actually given the album by his guitarist George Terry in the hope that he would enjoy the album. Eric Clapton was so impressed that he chose to record a cover version of I Shot the Sheriff, which became his first US hit since Layla 2 years earlier, and it reached number one on the Billboard Hot 100 on September 14th, 1974. I think most people probably know of the cover version over the original version, to be honest with you. The original is still just as good, honestly. But due to Eric Clapton having recorded this song, it now elevated Bob Marley and the Wailers' status, and it more so cemented them in rock history. Bob had his international breakthrough with his first hit outside Jamaica with a live version of No Woman, No Cry from the Live album. This was followed by his breakthrough album in the United States called Rastaman Vibration, which came out in 1976, which reached the top 50 of the Billboard Soul charts. So at this point in time, Bob Marley has cemented himself now as someone to not be trifled with. And he also was preaching about love. He was preaching about peace. He was a man of the people, and he didn't really want to sink his feet into politics at all. However, Jamaica being the country that it is, especially at that time, it was almost kind of hard to not really get involved in politics in some kind of way. Just to kind of break it down for you guys, to give you a little bit of backstory and some history, Jamaica was originally a colony of the United Kingdom, and they finally achieved their independence on July 19th, 1962. So he was starting when Jamaica had just become an independent nation. And the political landscape in Jamaica was defined by two rival groups, the People's National Party, which was a social democratic party, and then you had the Jamaica Labor Party, which was the more conservative counterpart to it, basically. And the tension between both of these groups led to violence, I think naturally, as it kind of does. Each group was outsourcing violence to these kids known as rude boys in Jamaica. And rude boys essentially were like young delinquents that were poor and disenfranchised with what was going on politically in Jamaica. So whichever group they decided to kind of like vie for, do their bidding for, they would get payouts from it, getting paid to do these things, these rude boys, but they were kind of also making a bit of a name for themselves also. So by the 1970s in Jamaica, the two opposing groups were in open warfare. It was a pretty hard time to live in Jamaica. The People's National Party was headed by Michael Manley and started openly supporting Fidel Castro and Cuban communism, but also Russian communism. So that's one side. And then the JLP was headed by a man named Edward Sega, and he bragged about the CIA supplying them with weapons. So the fact that America was supplying weapons to the JLP in this open warfare situation that was going on in Jamaica, it made it a very violent living situation for everyone in Jamaica. I think it was extremely hard to live there. There were people being killed in the hundreds. The warfare led to the death of nearly 900 people over the decade. So many died due to just the political warfare that was going on. You know, Bob Marley, of course, was living in Jamaica at this time while he was coming up in his fame, and he was aware of what was going on. He was preaching love and he was preaching peace, and he knew that if his message of peace and love wanted to be spread and wanted to be heard throughout all of Jamaica, and he wanted peace to be brought between the two parties, he knew that unfortunately sometimes he'd have to dip his toe into the political sphere. In 1972, the prime minister was Michael Manley, and by 1976, there was another election going on. So, you know, would Michael Manley be put back in or would it be Edward Sega? And by that point, Bob Marley had already backed Michael Manley in the 72 elections. But by the 76 elections, he just didn't want to get involved in politics. He didn't want to back anybody. He just wanted to remain neutral. And unfortunately, some people saw him being neutral as him being for the opposite side. So getting back to Bob Marley a little bit here, Bob went on a tour with Stevie Wonder. It was so sweet. They held a benefit concert in aid of blind children in Jamaica to raise funds for blind children. And that was so beautiful. They literally just did it out of the kindness of their heart to kind of raise awareness. And it was a free concert as well. And Bob really wanted to do something similar to that. He's like, you know, I really want to do another free concert while the elections are going on, to spread the message of peace and love during this really difficult time. So knowing that Bob wanted to do this concert, the PNP, Michael Manley's people, strategically moved the 1976 election dates to coincide with the concert that Bob was going to put on, which was called the Smile Jamaica concert, which would effectively turn it into a rally for the government. It's so much so that Michael Manley was like, hey, you can have the concert on the grounds of my political house. You can do that if you want. And Bob was like, that's not happening. It would for sure make it look like he was backing the PNP, which is not what he was trying to do. He was being neutral in this situation. So he decided to go on a neutral ground and say, let's go to this park instead and let's have it there. Michael Manley's people, I think, were a little annoyed at that. However, they allowed it to continue because they needed the approval from the government to go and actually have their concert, you know, on this national park property. So the Smile Jamaica concert was seemingly looking pretty okay. Everyone was set to go. They were rehearsing and practicing. However, the people of Jamaica themselves were seeing what was going on. They were seeing that Bob was remaining neutral, but at first he backed Michael Manley. So the two opposing sides were being very tunnel visioned on Bob Marley at this point, and he was enemy number one. So the day in question of Bob Marley's assassination attempt is December 3rd, 1976, which is 2 days before the Smile Jamaica concert. So Bob was at his house with his band and his wife, Rita, at 56 Hope Road in Jamaica, and the time is 8:30 p.m. Seven men approached Bob Marley's house. He and his band were on a break from rehearsal, and the home security detail was mysteriously missing that night, which never happened before. But surprisingly, the security that was supposed to be manning Bob's house, because Bob was getting death threats, his security wasn't there this night. So Bob's wife, Rita, she was in the driveway. She was in her car. She was leaving the house in her Volkswagen, and she stopped to let another car drive into the compound through the gate, which just was open. And she thought, that's weird. As the other car passed her, a man with a gun shot at her from the passenger seat, and the bullet grazed across her scalp, leaving her bloody but alive. So they shot her in the head, basically. She miraculously survived. And what saved her, people think, was the dreadlocks that she had. The dreadlocks kind of like stifled the bullet or protected her from, obviously, having been dead, because otherwise she would have been dead that night. Wailers keyboardist Tyrone Downey noticed that the moment the gunman broke in and we were rehearsing I Shot the Sheriff, Bob had stepped out because the horns weren't on that record and the horn players wanted to play on it. He came out of the rehearsal room and went into the kitchen to get a grapefruit or something. And all of a sudden, you see a hand come through the door, like around the door, and start firing this .38. Tyrone and the rest of the band hit the floor immediately, and they crawled into the bathroom to hide as best they could, some of them still carrying their instruments. And there were seven armed men, by the way, that came through. It wasn't just one lone man. They were just spraying random bullets, hoping to kind of get whoever they could in the crossfires. So one of these gunmen walked into the kitchen, and this is where they spotted Bob, who was tucked away in a corner. So they shot at him. A bullet grazed Bob across the chest, ultimately lodging in his left arm. So he was not wounded mortally, thank God. Bob joined his bandmates. Four or five of them were jammed into a bathtub, and they waited, of course, until, you know, medics arrived and police arrived. And it wasn't long before they heard a vehicle pull up outside, thank God. Rita came in. She was bleeding, but she's like, is Bob okay? Where's Bob? Like, miraculously, again, this woman survived. Miraculously, everyone also survived. No one died this night, but they all did go to the university hospital where they were treated. His manager, Don Taylor, was shot in the legs and torso. Band employee Lewis Griffiths took a bullet to his torso as well. But again, no fatalities. This is just so interesting. Bob Marley said that a couple days before this assassination attempt happened, he had a dream where he was being shot at, but he heard a voice tell him to stand up and to walk.
What happened when you were shot? You were in your home.
Yeah.
Was it in the morning or at night or what happened?
Well, it was about, that's about 9 o'clock in the night. What happened is that the night before, about 3 nights before that, I was living at a place called Bulby, you know? And I went to about 3 o'clock in the morning and get some sleep. And then I vision I was in a lot of gunshot. That was a dream. I was in a barrage, a gunshot. But when it all over, you know, it's like me never really getting a shot. But me see my mother get shot. You know, the vision show my mother get shot in her head. And what happened is that the vision said, don't run. You know, it's like, do you know all of this gunshot? It's like something that the vision said, don't run. Stand up. So when the gunshot started firing on Hope Road, the first thing come back to my mind was the vision.
And he took the gunfire that happened. And so you could say that he got a premonition that this was going to happen to him. This went to trial, obviously, and they were brought to justice swiftly. Bob told the concert chairman, because obviously 2 days later, after this point, was supposed to be the concert, and they were all shot at. So he had to tell the concert chairman what was happening. Bob Marley told him that he thought Edward Sega was alleged to have ordered his bodyguard, Lester Jim Brown Coke, to issue out the shooting. That's why security detail was not there. After the shooting, numerous reports indicated that the gunmen returned to Trivoli Gardens, which was a neighborhood loyal to the Jamaican Labor Party. This is where the whole conspiracy theory comes about. Did the CIA issue this assassination attempt? It all kind of seems to make some kind of sense. Like Bob Marley was almost getting a little too close to the sun, if you will. So after the shooting, the American Embassy sent a cable titled Reggae Star Shot, Motive Probably Political. And in the cable, the American Embassy wrote this. Some see the incident as an attempt by JPL gunmen to halt the concert, which would feature the politically progressive music of Marley and other reggae stars. Others see it as a deep-laid plot to create progressive, youthful Jamaican martyr to the benefit of the PNP. Those holding the latter view note that the four persons shot, three of them including Marley, only suffered minor wounds. Well, that's the thing, though. If Bob Marley had died at this time, they would have succeeded in their plot, and it would have been at the behest of their political opponents. But Bob Marley just got caught up in the crossfires of this political smear campaign, if you will. Bob said that while he never saw the gunman himself during the assassination attempt, he was familiar with who attempted to take his life. He ain't no snitch. He's not going to tell. Timothy White is a biographer, and he did a biography on Bob Marley. And it was on good authority that he had received information from JPL officials and law enforcement officials. He believed that a JPL gunman known as Carl Baya Mitchell was contacted by the CIA to organize the shooting, and that Lester Coke, again, his bodyguard, led the charge on Bob Marley's house. Don Taylor, who was Bob's manager, claimed that both he and Bob Marley were present at court when the gunmen were tried, and they were actually executed, although Bob really was trying to vie for them not to be executed, because that was against his moral compass for these people to die. He was too good for this world, honestly. He was so nice. But he didn't want them to die just because of him, but they were executed. Some of them were hung, and then some of the other ones were shot. But according to Don Taylor, before one of the shooters was killed, the shooter claimed, that the job was done for the CIA in exchange for cocaine and guns. I can see this happening, so, you know, I believe personally that that is what happened. But again, it's all a conspiracy theory whether the CIA was ever involved, but clearly it was a political assassination attempt. But following the incident, Bob was scared for his life, rightfully so, and he moved to England, where he spent 2 years in a self-imposed exile, which is funny because this is where he recorded his very famous album, Exodus. He knew in England that people would not try to come for him. England had and still does actually, a very large, bustling, booming reggae scene going on there. They're a melting pot of a lot of different cultures, but reggae was, and still is, I think, pretty big in the UK. So he felt very much so like right at home and very comfortable in England. Plus, of course, he knew that he would be totally safe. Reggae archivist Roger Steffens said this: "It was tremendously depressing because he had been helping the people who came to shoot him. He'd been giving them money. He'd been giving them food. He just couldn't understand how these people could betray him so terribly. It was a very depressing time for him in that year that followed," where he moved to England. So this is another conspiracy theory. Again, completely unfounded. But a lot of people seem to think that this is also what happened. So Bob, he was living in England at this time, and there was this man named Bill Oxley, and he claimed to be a former CIA operative. According to his story, he dressed as a photographer under the guise of meeting Bob Marley in England and like sitting down with him, interviewing him, like getting photos of him and stuff like for a purported magazine, right? He also claimed that he gave Bob a pair of Converse sneakers. In the Converse sneaker in the toe box at the front of the shoe, he put inside a contaminated piece of shrapnel, metal, something like that, a needle that was coated in cancerous type of material. So he put this in the front of Bob Marley's shoe, and when Bob went to try on the shoe, apparently, according to this Bill Oxley, Bob Marley yelped because the needle or the metal shrapnel coated with this cancerous material pierced his skin, his toe. And unfortunately, sometime after that, Bob would end up getting cancer that started in his toe. You know, some people thought, well, maybe he got cancer in his foot because he played soccer a lot. Well, they also call it football. I believe they might call it football in Jamaica, but soccer. He used to love playing soccer all the time, but we're like, no, he couldn't have gotten cancer from playing soccer. That doesn't make sense. That's the only kind of way that people seem to think that he got cancer. But Bill Oxley, while he claimed to be a CIA operative, the CIA has never confirmed Bill to be an operative, but why would they claim him to be one? You know, now I'm going deep into the lore. I understand it, but why would they confirm that he would be an operative? I would imagine that they would protect that information. Oh no, we can't confirm whether he was or not. I mean, it kind of makes sense to me, but like I said, that's the theory that people seem to go on here. So it's really unfortunate because he had this going on, but at the same time, he was coming up in his music career even more. Because again, the album Exodus, he also had an album called Uprising in 1980. It was his most religious album that he ever done. And it includes the song Redemption Song, which is also one of his most famous songs. So in this time in England, in this self-induced exile, he made a lot of his most famous music that people know of today. Exodus, I think, is touted as one of his best, if not his most famous album that he's done. Being in England did him some good, actually. He was thriving there. He was doing really good there. But unfortunately, he ended up getting diagnosed with a malignant melanoma at the time, which was under the nail of his right big toe. And he got diagnosed with that in July of 1977. So unlike other melanomas, which usually appear on skin exposed to the sun, his form of melanoma occurs in places that are easy to miss, such as the soles of the feet or under toenails. Interestingly enough, at that time, a lot of medical textbooks, according to what I've read, didn't even really have a lot of information on his specific type of melanoma. His doctors urged him to amputate his toe because that was the only way that they could save him from the cancer being spread. But Bob was against doing these kinds of medical procedures. So instead of amputating his toe, he ended up doing a procedure where the nail and the nail bed of his toe were removed and a skin graft was taken from his thigh to cover the area. And that was doing okay for him for a couple of years until it just progressed further and further and further, because at this time he was doing a tour for his albums. The last concert that he did took place 2 days after he scheduled his 1980 world tour, which is very ostentatious of him to do considering he had cancer. And it was at the Stanley Theater in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And this happened on the 23rd of September, 1980. So that's the last concert that he ever attended. But unfortunately, his cancer was spreading pretty badly throughout his body. The rest of the tour was canceled. and Bob sought treatment in Bavaria, Germany, where he underwent an alternative treatment. The avoidance of certain foods, drinks, and other kinds of substances. Again, a very holistic approach, which at this point is not going to help him. You know, he just wanted to try to heal his body as naturally as he could. And that's the ethos that he always had, you know, be as natural and as green as possible, you know. But after 8 months of failing to treat his cancer, he knew that his time was coming to a close. And so he's like, I want to go back home to Jamaica because that's where he loved the most. He loved Jamaica, his home, even though it was rife with a lot of political crap. And he almost died in Jamaica due to his own people. He loved his home of Jamaica. So he knew his time was running out. And so he boarded a plane with his band for Jamaica. During the flight back home to Jamaica, his vital functions worsened and he was quickly approaching death's door. So they made an emergency landing in Miami, Florida, and he was taken to Cedars of Lebanon Hospital for immediate medical attention. But unfortunately, he died on May 11th, 1981 at age 36 due to his cancer. His final words to his son Ziggy were this: on your way up, take me up. On your way down, don't let me down. So, a legend at only 36 years old had died due to cancer. Bob was given a state funeral in Jamaica on the 21st of May, 1981, and he was buried in a chapel near his birthplace in Nine Mile. His casket contained his red Gibson Les Paul, a Bible that was opened at Psalm 23, and a bit of weed that was placed in there by his widow, Rita. Edward Sega was the one that came through to deliver the eulogy. However, maybe you could say that in his death, he achieved what he wanted, which was both the political opponents to come together. So this is what Edward Sega had to say in his eulogy. His voice was an omnipresent cry in our electronic world. His sharp features, majestic looks, and prancing style, a vivid etching on the landscape of our minds. Bob Marley was never seen. He was an experience which left an indelible imprint with each encounter. Such a man cannot be erased from the mind. He is part of the collective consciousness of the nation. And such, Bob Marley's legacy has been kept alive and well. And here we have a biopic of him, which I think, I don't know if there was ever one done previously to the one that was released, but it was long overdue. But thank you guys so much for listening. And I hope you guys enjoyed the story. I'm trying to kind of find more true crime stories that took place in the music industry because I know that you guys seem to really enjoy those kinds of episodes. I figured doing this one on Bob Marley's attempted assassination was a really good place to kind of keep propelling that kind of content. So if you enjoyed, rate the podcast on any platform that you listen to it, Apple, Google, or Spotify, or any of the other ones. That would be greatly appreciated by me. Also, if you would like to follow the podcast on Instagram, I have that in the description. And also, if you would like to monetarily support the podcast any way that you'd like, I have all of that information down below in the description as well for you guys to check out. Any and all donations that you guys would be so charitable to give me are going to go right back into the podcast, making it bigger and better for you guys. So thank you guys so much for listening. I hope you guys enjoyed and you learned something today that you hadn't known about before. And I will see you guys with another episode of On the Mix. Talk to you guys later. Bye, guys.